Hello and welcome to Colonial Console, RMU Century Media's video game podcast. My name is Malik Johnson. I'm here with Garrett Roberts and Tyler Coates, who we'll be talking to later. This week we've got a bunch of cool conversations. I've been playing Valkyria Chronicles 4, and one of my favorite handhelds of all time, the PlayStation Vita, is going to be ending production in Japan, finally putting the nail in that coffin. Let's get started. Garrett, you've been playing through the original Valkyria Chronicles, which is one of my favorite games on PlayStation 3.
I've been playing the remastered PS4 version of it, and it's definitely one of the more interesting strategy games you can play on the PlayStation 4. It's something I really haven't seen before. You see a lot of top-down strategy games on like portable consoles, so having that on a home console in a 3D setting is unique for it.
What was really interesting about the original Valkyria Chronicles when it released, it was the battle system. I don't remember the name of what they called it right now off the top of my head. But the idea that you control the units from a top-down map perspective, and then you can zoom in and you control each individual soldier in third person, that was like the main thing. And then the art style is gorgeous. It's hand-painted.
Yeah, the storybook art style definitely lends itself really well to how the game plays. And while I haven't gone too in-depth with the system yet, it already shows its massive potential for like future games and everything and how they can vary it up.
Yeah, so what's really interesting is that they don't do that. We're four games in now, and Valkyria Chronicles 2 was originally how I found the series. I played the demo on PSP. Valkyria Chronicles 2, it introduces another class. I think it's a person with a sword. And then we have Valkyria Chronicles 3, which doesn't get released in America. Still hasn't. It's a Japan-only thing. And then we have Valkyria Revolution, which came out last year, and it was an action RPG instead of the like normal strategy game. But like all of those, I think 2 was received really well, 3 was received really well, never came into America. Revolution, everyone hated. There's like, this isn't the Valkyria Chronicles we love.
I guess that leads into, how was 4?
Four is really good. So I am maybe about just under halfway through the game right now. I've been playing it as much as I can. The Valkyria Chronicle games aren't easy games by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, no, I can tell.
So it's been pretty good. They do add a lot of things. They added the Grenadier class, which is like a mortar, person. And I think that really was one of the things that they added that changes the entire way you think about that map. Because now I can hit people meters out or kilometers out, and I don't have to see people. I can shoot over houses. I can shoot over walls. And that makes it so much different than the original Valkyria Chronicles 1, because it was always, the scout was the thing that you wanted, and you always brought the scout with you because they have the highest sight line. Also, they've introduced, I just got to the point where now you can have leaders in your crew. They just added a bunch of stuff. Like, leaders in your crew can now take other soldiers and have them follow them, which changes the entire game, because now snipers, who traditionally have very low mobility and can't go as far in a turn as, say, a scout, you can use a scout to drag a sniper to the sniper tower it needs to be, or a shock trooper. One thing that I like to do is I have to take the troopers, the like foot soldier units, and pair them up. So instead of going in with one, I now instantly have, you know, two or three going into a firefight. They added a ship, which is really cool. And I haven't gotten too far into this. This is mid-halfway part of the game. But the ship allows you to do a bunch of really cool things. You can rescue your soldiers after they've fallen. Just clean sweep rescue. You have a radar, which is really cool.
So, I don't know if you've played the Fire Emblem games.
Yeah, I've played bits and pieces. I joined, I think, during Awakening when Fire Emblem became mainstream.
So then you would know about the like pairing up mechanic. Is it similar to Fire Emblem's pairing up?
So it's not. So what's really cool is in Fire Emblem Awakening, you pair two units together and they fight together, and they like move as one separate unit. In Valkyria Chronicles, they're always separate units. They will always be separate units, and in the game with the leadership command, it is something you do once per turn. Once per turn, you can have a leader drag other units with him. It doesn't always add boost. I know a lot of times, especially if you're using like a scout, which is a faster unit, and you bring a sniper, which is slower, the sniper will get like caught between things. They'll like lag behind. So if you attack before that sniper gets there, the sniper's just not going to help you out because they're not there. As opposed to Fire Emblem, where they move as two separate things. What's also really cool is the personality part of Valkyria Chronicles. The original Valkyria Chronicles did this too, but each unit has their own personality traits that they like. So you might have a scout that hates men, and every time that they're around men, their defense drops. You might have an author, right? Occasionally, he'll just get really upset because he's not a well-published author. And, like, it'll just happen. And in Valkyria Chronicles 4, what they did to expand on that is that by using different units with other troopers that they like, you unlock squad stories, which are, like, little side missions that you can go on that flesh out kind of characters. But what it also does is it takes some of those negative traits and it turns them into positive. Like, it shows a growth over the course of, like, the war. And so I had, for example, I have an engineer who loves tanks, and every time you give him in front of a tank, he gets completely distracted, his defense drops, and I do a squad story. And well, now, instead of getting distracted by tanks, he loves tanks and he respects tanks enough that he'll sometimes fix a tank and he'll get another action. He'll get another turn out of it.
So how is the story for this one? Like, what is the basis of the war in this one?
So Valkyria Chronicles 4 goes back to the original war in Valkyria Chronicles 1. Mm-hmm. The Great War. I don't remember which Great War it was.
There's always great wars in these games.
Yeah, a great war. Some war has happened that has engulfed the world. But it follows where the original game had you on the Galleon front, attacking the Imperial set. This has you playing as Claude Wallace, who was valedictorian in the military academy. And he is leading the elite Ranger Corps in a direct fight through the Empire. So they're like marching through the Empire trying to get to the capital. So there are actually points in the game where, I think one early on, where over the radio comms, you can hear them like mentioning things that happened in Valkyria Chronicles 1. I think it's actually like a really important mission in Valkyria Chronicles 1 that they call back to.
Would you need to play 1, 2, or 3 to understand 4?
Well, you can't play 3.
Oh, yeah, well, could you play 1 or 2 to understand?
No, you don't have to. It's completely standalone. They take you through everything. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm halfway through the game and I'm still being introduced to new things. Two weeks ago, right after we recorded our last episode, they announced that the PlayStation Vita ends production in Japan. It ended production in the United States a while back. Japan is the only place where you can buy a Vita currently. And soon that's going to be no more.
Mm-hmm. It is definitely, you could see the kind of declining trend of it. Because originally the Vita was advertised as it's going to be this big new handheld. And then the 3DS came out and it was, and a lot of the like mainstream audience that was developing for Vita started to shift over to Nintendo's platform. Like with Arkham and all those games, they were originally on the Vita, but slowly like the Lego games and all that moved there. And all that was left for the Vita was kind of like more niche games.
See, what I really liked about the Vita was that there were those niche games. I picked it up around that time where it was niche games.
Mm-hmm.
You would often hear from like indie developers that the Vita has a super high attach rate. The people who bought Vitas also bought a lot of games, and that was what like kept it sustainable for as long as it was. It would have died a lot sooner if it weren't for that really high attach rate, if it wasn't for that like very, very feverish community that the Vita has. And I think the Switch is definitely what caused the Vita to die out in Japan. I mean, it's a cultural thing there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to say, I've never even known anyone that's owned a Vita. Like, that's how relevant I feel it is in at least America, you know? It didn't have as big of a turnout, so I agree completely that the reason why it was sustained for so long is because of the fact that so many people bought games for it. They realized, hey, this is a good system, this is interesting. I don't know if it was a problem with, you know, the marketing of the Vita or anything like that, but personally, I can't name one person I know that owned a Vita. I owned a PlayStation Portable, but never a Vita.
A lot of people who follow like the Vita, a lot of like feverish Vita people, they say it was the market. It was that Sony advertised it as the PS3 Portable. You know, it was supposed to have this big Uncharted games. It was supposed to have, you know, all these big cinematic masterpieces, and then Sony just never gave the Vita those games. And that's why it often was called the indie machine, because that's where the name comes from. The indie machine is.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it the first portable console to introduce streaming to it? Like, that's how you would play your games on it? Would it be streamed from a console or something different like that?
So what you could do is you could stream the PS3, the PS3 3 and the PS4, I think, via remote play. It was started in the PS3 and then really, really became a thing in the PS4, was that you can play your PS4 on the PlayStation Vita over the internet. So, and you could do that over Wi-Fi, states away. People have done it, I think, countries away. So it was that, it was a really cool idea. You can take your home console experience, bring it on the go with you.
And then the Switch copied it.
The Switch arguably did it. The Switch arguably did it better. Yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, the Vita was also kind of a prototype even for the PlayStation TV, where you could then stream it from. It was like a much smaller version, and then you could take those Vita games and put them on a bigger screen. So a lot of people who were early supporters of the Vita just went, well, look, now we can buy this for half the price and play all the games.
The Vita TV, I think, was probably one of the worst things of that generation. It there was no purpose for it.
Mm-hmm.
I refused to buy it before it went under $40, because it doesn't play any games on its own. Like, the Vita played games on its own, and it had a reason to own a Vita. The Vita TV was a cable box, essentially.
Yeah, honestly, I bought it for $40 and then didn't hook it up for about a year.
Oh, yeah, I still don't have mine hooked up.
But then I hooked it up and started playing some Vita games on it again, and it's a lot better to play with that controller in your hand at times, but if they wanted to sell more Vitas, they shouldn't have even considered making it. Another problem was probably, like, the game library going forward. At the beginning, they got a lot of their good games out of the way, like Persona 4 Golden. And all of those games were immensely popular, but as time went on, they stopped developing more and more for it.
Well, around that time, Sony closed down a lot of its first-party studios. You saw that with Zip, Big, and a bunch of other studios that I can't name off the top of my head. And a lot of them were, like, you would go to develop a Vita game, and you would get closed down right after the Vita game would open, because, like, there was just, I don't know if at that time there weren't people buying Vita games, or, like, Vitas weren't selling the way that people expected it to.
Well, there's a lot of creative games for the Vita. I mean, it's just nobody owned it, so they didn't try them out. One that I picked up for $5 was Freedom Wars, and it was...
Oh, Freedom Wars is great.
And it was, like, a really good game, but nobody played it because they didn't own a Vita. I think if they, like, moved a lot of the Vita's library to PS4, updated it, put it on a better engine or something, it would work out phenomenally.
Now, do we think that there's going to be a Vita 2 at some point, or another PlayStation Portable? Because this is Sony's second chance, and the PSP, not super profitable, because people just used it to, like, place NES emulators, and then the Vita TV, not super great.
I think it comes down to what the market comes down to. Like, we need to look and see exactly what's ruling the market right now in terms of portability. Arguably, you could say that the smartphones are becoming so strong that eventually portable systems will be obsolete. And I mean, you can look at how successful the 3DS was and how successful the Vita was, and see if it was like a downward trend in comparison to just a regular DS and a PSP. And from what I've noticed, it seems like it's definitely on a downward trend, the portable gaming consoles and all of that. So saying that Sony might come out with another one, I wouldn't trust Sony to be the ones to, like, push forward with that innovate thing. Usually it's Nintendo that tries out new stuff. Like, they do the risk. Sony's more careful with how they go about their marketing.
But could you say that Nintendo already did
with the Switch? Very much so. You could say that is technically a portable console. But I can't say, because I'm not a Switch owner. So I'm not going to go on a whim and say, oh, it's the best portable console out there or anything. Or nah, I use it all the time. I know someone who does, and I know they take it with them everywhere. So to me, it could arguably be the next portable dominator. And at that point, is it even worth Sony going into the competitive market like that in something that could be potentially dying?
Yeah,
I don't see it happening.
And then it raises even a bigger question of, which way would Sony want to go? Would they want to push more into VR as their, like, gimmick console, or do they want to go Switch way and have, like, the PlayStation 5 be portable?
That's a good topic there. Perhaps with their newest console, they might make it portable. That's something I could very well see them doing if it's going to be their mainstay console. They could reach out to that. But you have to keep in mind, what does an average Sony consumer look for in the console? What do you look for in a Nintendo console? They get away with a lot more things. Like, you know, you expect Nintendo to do the Wii. You expect them to do the Wii U and that sort of thing. Whereas with Sony and Microsoft, you expect them to be more home-state consoles, more gaming power, more graphics, mm-hmm. online play, all this, and right at the door. So, I don't know. I could see they might notice it as a competitive market, but it depends on how successful the Switch does. And if they're able to back it up with some good graphics power, that's going to sustain a few years, which... portability with that kind of power is a bit tough to manage. They could go back onto streaming services, but I don't know. That one's kind of tough to gauge, in my opinion.
Yeah, and with something like first-person shooters, the Switch controllers don't really lend themselves to that.
Exactly.
Mouse and keyboard will also be the ultimate for that, but I mean, there's plenty of people who play Call of Duty on a PlayStation 4.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper than a $1,000 gaming computer, and that's really Sony's big competition at this point.
You could argue that for Microsoft as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not to get us off topic or anything, but the PC market, the gaming PC market has definitely skyrocketed in the past 10 years. That's mm-hmm. a fact.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Sony will have to deal with a new portable console or even their just next gimmick console is what can it do that a PC can't?
All right, that's all we have. Thank you, Garrett and Tyler. When we come back from break, Tyler, you're the president of the Colonial Esports Club. We're going to talk more about that.
Well, I can't wait.
Welcome back to Colonial Console, Army Century Media's video game podcast. My name is Malik Johnson, the news editor. Garrett Roberts, the assistant arts entertainment manager, is here with me.
Hello.
And we have Tyler Coates, president of the Colonial Esports Club, with us today.
That's me.
Tell me about the Colonial Esports Club.
Well, we're an association, an organization, whatever you want to call it, that focuses primarily on trying to really tap into... nerds and other students' potentials, turning hobbies into something productive and making them, meet more people and just, brotherhood in general. We're like a fraternity, but without the, extreme costs and stupidity.
What teams do you currently have set up for the Colonial Esports Club?
The teams we have currently set up for the Esports Club would be the Rocket League team featuring Ryan Conti, Norman Riffner, and Chris... can't tell you his last name, it is lost off the top of my head. And then we're having the CSGO team, which is more for the SGA club than the club sports itself, which features Luke Brown, Son Bui, Ryan Conti, and Norman Riffner.
You previously competed in the TESPA tournaments. Do you still plan to like keep that up with these teams?
With the TESPA Collegiate Series, we've had our time in the spotlight with those, so we've been trying to reach out to more members to see if they want to take over our positions for it. Because, we've gone through it. We've had a good time. And we're more than happy to do it again, but we don't want to hog the spotlight. So it is definitely continuing.
So the 24-hour gaming marathon is coming up. What exactly are you guys doing? Are you guys involved in that at all?
Absolutely. I'm very close with Karen Paulette, the advisor for the Top Secret Colonials. I know decently close with most of their staff as well, their board, the treasurer and the president and all that. Evan Kidney's a great guy. He knows he's going places in life. I can tell that. And what we're planning on doing with the club is exactly what we did last year. We're going to try to do a tournament within it, try to, advertise for ourselves at the 24-hour gaming marathon. And we're also probably going to be doing some management with their tournaments. They haven't really reached out to me to the point of asking me to do the tournaments for them, but I would never be opposed. We have plenty of gifts to give away in the club, so if it's ever needed to supply any of that for incentives for charity, we can definitely do that as well. Tournament we're most likely going to be doing is going to be Overwatch tournament, similar to last year, 1v1. I still want to push forward for the all Junkrat tournament, but I don't know. That might just be a pipe dream of mine, never going to come true. Fingers crossed, though.
Do you have any plans for anything else on campus to, like... community events in Romo's or stuff like that?
Well, for future events we're planning on doing on campus, definitely more tournaments. We've already started off on the right foot despite, you know, disputes with SGA and, you know, the ResTech and all this. We've started a lot earlier with what we want to do this year. We're working on getting a framework for a calendar, you know, for us to just get stuff organized for next semester as well. We already have done a LAN party on campus, which was in Salem Hall last week, the 28th, and we had a big turnout, the biggest turnout ever for our LAN, which was about 20 members showed up. And that was even after, you know, the regulars didn't come. So I was very happy about that. For the tournaments, we are most definitely doing a Hearthstone tournament this year and most likely going to do it for each semester. So one this semester and one the next. It's going to have a basic bracket as well as a standard bracket. The basic bracket being for new members to just hop in and, you know, doesn't really cost them any money to do so.
So for the LAN parties, are those exclusive to the club or are they open to people who even want to just learn more about the esports team and kind of play with the team?
We definitely welcome students to come and check us out, see what we're doing. But with the new implementation of dues that are going to be added to the club, a $10 due, you get a t-shirt. You also get free access to all of the events that we host. This includes tournament buy-ins and all of that. So with that, we are going to be a little bit more strict with who we let into the LAN parties and the tournaments and all of that. Like, we'll still allow just students to participate in those, but there's going to be a buy-in. A small buy-in, but nothing extreme.
So how do people who want to get involved in these esports teams, how do they get involved? Who do they reach out to?
We have two sectors for our club. We have the people that pay the dues, and we have just the regular members that are signed up on WorkSync, in our Discord channel, etc. And basically, we allow anybody to be a part of a team. And we encourage our members to look out for other tournaments, you know, band together. We can help them however, like, our powers will enable us to. And it's as simple as that. If you think you want to join a team, if you enjoy playing a game, nothing is stopping you from saying, hey, guys, let's start this up. Like, you can even reach out to myself or one of my staff members or just other members in general and try to form your own thing. It's just the structure of the club is just to help people, you know, meet each other for these events.
So what separates the due paying members from the non-due paying members? Is it just the free tournament buy-ins? Is it extras?
It's more so how much it lets us know who wants to be involved in the club. And this is a common thing with any SGA club. You're going to have 180 members and you'll have only 20 show up to meetings, and like regulars show up to meetings. So with the use of a due system, it allows us to really focus on the people that seem to be the most interested in the club, not just the background noise, you know. And what we get out of that is new members, or not even new members, just people that pay dues will receive a t-shirt designed by our club itself, and they will also get the free buy-ins for events. They'll get to go into the LANs, anything we host, absolutely free, gratis, and you'll be kept up to date on everything we have outside of the Discord channel and the, you know, open-air stuff we usually talk about.
Okay. Were the dues, was that a club decision, or was that because that you guys are both SGA and club sports?
That was a club decision. We have decided that this year it would be in our best interest to raise the funds a bit for how many more events we've been planning, and we figured dues would be a great way to up involvement, because, you know, if you spend money on something, normally you're going to be more involved with it because you want to get your money back out of it, which with ours, I feel that's a very good deal. $10 for all of those.
What were those conversations like? Did somebody just bring it up in a meeting? Was it a thing that people have been talking about for a while and someone finally put their foot down?
With dues? Well, with the dues, it was something we had up in the air for a while, and it was just we couldn't really go about implementing it until the start of a year. Because at the end of the first semester of last year, the idea was presented to me. And I just thought about it. I was like, how can I do this? I don't want to put out these people, because we had the biggest turnout, like, in growth at the beginning of last year, which was nearly quintuple our members. We had, like, a 50-member increase immediately at the start of the year. So I'm like, oh, we have all these new members. I don't know what we should do for dues, or, like, if we should make them pay something. So I just kept it free for that entire year. And then as we went through to the next semester, I started frameworking a few things. I talked with my treasurer, with my secretaries, and we all agreed that, you know, what are we going to get out of this? what's going to keep members in the club, what's going to increase our involvement, and we decided upon the $10 dues and what they get out of it. And we all agree that it's a pretty fair price for what you'd pay for it.
Yeah, how did you guys decide on $10? Because like I don't know specifically, but it seems like a very little money for all of the tournament buy-ins and the shirt.
It is, and it's just we're hoping that people will understand that we're really trying our hardest here just to get people more involved and to really up our recognition as a club. Like we want to be like I'm not going to say our aspirations, but I would like to be recognized as one of the larger clubs on campus before I graduate. Because it's just, to me, it seems like it's such a growing thing. And I want the college executives, I want the professors, I want everyone to realize that this is a growing thing in, you know, universities. And no longer is it just a hobby. It's a lifestyle for a lot of people. And adding that with the background of actually bringing people who are, you know, lack of better words, shut-ins in their houses or playing video games all the time, if that gets them out to come study and learn more things and get a trade or anything, that's good work in my eyes.
I have one follow-up question. What was the difference when you guys became both a club sport and an SGA club? What changed in the club?
It was a tone of seriousness, I feel. Like when we began the club freshman year 2 years ago, it was not even like we never expected it to be what it is today. We started out, I was talking to my treasurer, Norman Riffner, and my secretary, Ryan Conti, and we were all from the same high school. So we already knew each other, and we're like, hey, Conti brings to my attention that there's a tournament, and it was for the TESPA Collegiate Series for an Overwatch match. And we had only the three of us that actually owned the game on PC. So we're thinking, geez, how are we going to do this if we don't have people? So we just end up reaching out to people. And we formed the club. We're like, hey, we all like this game. Let's start it. We formed the Colonial Overwatch Club, which was originally supposed to just be for, you know, that game. And through that, we met Joseph Fucci, who was our one of our attackers on offensive attackers in Overwatch. Then we met Matthew Crawford, who was one of our tanks for it. And through that, we all just sort of formed a bond. And now Joseph Fucci is one of my most prevalent members. He always comes to every meeting he can. And Matthew Crawford, he's now my social media head. So just from the relations we had with that, it was one heck of a time. But the differences between the club sports and then is just we can focus more. We're more organized. We know what we want. Our end goal is clear. We want to get people exposed to these tournaments. We want them to have a good time. We want them to meet other people and hopefully get something out of it from their talents with these video games.
I guess to kind of like get into some more of the deep stuff, there was a bit of a confusion over whether you guys would be allowed to play FPS games. Could you talk a little bit about that?
In terms of whether or not we're allowed to play first-person shooters, it's still very much up in the air because we're considered essentially both a club sport program and a student government association program. So we have the ability to do certain things in one part of it, and we don't have the ability in other things to do it. So in the club sport program, we're not allowed to do first-person shooter games such as Overwatch, CSGO, Call of Duty, etc. Even I believe Fortnite, even though it's not a first-person shooter, it's was heavily implied that any type of shooter is really getting knocked off the list for that. So we keep those sort of tournaments to the SGA club. We're not so verbose about it. We don't try to advertise it much with the backing of RMU, but we're still allowed to do it in the sense that we're not fully representing it in the club sports program. Whereas for games like Rocket League and League of Legends, we're allowed to do that with the club sports.
Is there any like particular reason for not being able to play like FPS? Like, is it the blood or guns or something?
If I had to take a guess, I've never spoken with the executives myself. This has all been through my advisor, Armand Bozzelli, and from what he told me, it's essentially, I would imagine it to be a displacement between students and executives. You know, you have, they're wise and they know what they're doing, but at the same time, they haven't been exposed to what we have been, you know, the younger generation, the students, and so they're not really that exposed to what video games are, and they just see oh, this guy, this one has a shooter in it, and this one has this and that in it. Do we want that representing us as a school? And obviously, they're going to look at the guns and say, violence is never something to be looked at, you know, kindly. So they stray away from that. And we're hoping that eventually we can get them to come around just by how involved we can become with the club sport program. So we show them that we're, you know, not just this up-and-comer thing. We're actually a big force to go through with RMU with recruiting new students and, you know, getting more participation out of those students. So we show them that, and we're hoping that it might open their eyes up or at least get us a meeting with them to discuss exactly what we would plan on doing with first-person shooters and games like that.
Do you know if other universities are having this problem right now?
To my knowledge, I know Slippery Rock just opened up a new sector for esports. And it wasn't, I don't believe it's anything official. I think it's a club sport, or not even a club sport program, just like a video game competitive sport club, you know. So not club sports per se. I know Point Park was going really hard for it. CMU actually has their own program they've been doing. They were, not necessarily the founders of it, but they haven't gone through any outside resources for it. Whereas RMU, we've been reaching out to, say, the Pittsburgh Knights, you know, the Pittsburgh official esports team, and all that to really find a good ground for us to stand on. They've just kind of been going on their own thing. And to my knowledge, Point Park, it might have been Point Park. This might be a different college, but I was pretty sure it's Point Park that had their esports head, like their manager, just back out and started coaching for some professional esports team. And I can't remember what team it was. It might have been Cloud9, but that information is unknown to me, which team. But she did drop out from that, being the manager, and then went to work with some professional team. So it's a very it's unstable right now. Like, and colleges are realizing that there's potential in it, but it's very difficult to go about how to manage this sort of thing. And I'm hoping RMU, with RMU, we're going to have the correct framework to do so. And we've been taking our time with it. We've been really, you know, trying to think things through, not rushing into anything. And we're hoping that we're going to find something eventually that will fit us perfectly.
I guess the final question is, where can people get a hold of you?
Oh, well, you can reach me at tjcst295@mail.rmu.edu. You can also message me on OrcSync under the Colonial Esports Club. It should be right on the page. Feel free to email me at any time on there or on just the email, and I can send you the Discord link where we constantly post all our announcements as well as get members involved outside of, you know, emails and events. Very much recommend joining that if you have even the slightest interest in our club.
All right. Thank you, Tyler.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for listening to the Colonial Console Podcast on RMUCenturyMedia.com and RMU Radio.